Succession number 9927, reel number 5.
Reel 5. I'd now like to ask you about the next stage of your war, which I believe is your convalescence and return to Blighty, where I think you took a commission. Am I right in thinking that? You applied for a commission.
Well, to be exact, we, two or three sergeants, were sent for by the brigadier when we were back in England, and he decided after discussion that he would put us forward for training as officers. With my bosom friend, Lionel Russell, and I, we were sent to the Officers Training Battalion at Lichfield for 5 months training, in which period they were taking the entire 2-year Sandhurst course. We worked every day, we worked every evening, we worked on Sundays, and in that period of 5 months there, we did as much work as they would give at 2 years in Sandhurst. There were 180 men, and in the final 3 days examination, I came seventh on the list. I think I came rather better than I deserved, because it was always my practice to carry with me coloured crayons, because I'm very fond of art. And so I had drawn the various maps that were required, or pictures of the manoeuvres, and I coloured my contributions, and I was told quietly afterwards by one of the young officers that we had great fun when we got to your papers, because we thought they were good enough, and so we pinned them up all around the mess walls. So I think they probably helped me get as reasonably high as I would. I'd like to be number one, but I was number seven, as a matter of fact, out of 180, I think it was. So
it sounds awfully intensive, that course, five months.
It was amazing. It was intensive. It was terrific.
What subjects did you have to study?
Well, various officers came and told us different points of military service required. We studied maps, of course. We went out on the countryside. We paraded, we marched, we did all the things that soldiers should do. And, as I say, at the end, we were commissioned. And in my case, to my surprise, and with my bosom friend with me, we were both made officers of the East Surrey Regiment, having come from the West Surrey.
Do you think it helped you to become a good officer, having been in the ranks?
I think it was very valuable. I don't know. Yes, I suppose your answer to that is yes. That obviously you knew quite a lot about the ranks of problems, and you could understand that. I found that once you had a platoon and you were in France, the interest between the officer and his platoon became one of deep confidence and even almost affection. And I know that, as I should be telling you, I eventually transferred from the infantry, that leaving my platoon in the trenches, they were really sad and shaking hands and wishing me the best of good fortune, and I felt I was leaving a group of good friends. And throughout what I'm quite sure that service in the ranks was invaluable from the point of view of understanding their point of view. I had greater discomforts than many of my own men. I had slept on the trench and being trodden on at night and so on. I had found a big stone in the centre of a trench that I could curl around to get out of the way of being trodden on when sleeping, and I slept curled around this stone for some time. So that conditions like that made it possible for the officer to know what the soldier's problems are.
When you became an officer, you would have had your batman, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Did you think that the standard of living of officers generally was very much above the other ranks and should have been? You know, did you have any particular feelings on that, having been in the ranks yourself? Was it right that officers should have these perks of batmen?
Well, I don't propose, at least I'm not in a position to argue about that, because I was perfectly happy with the conditions as they were, but I must admit that when in the line, it was the same shell that hit the officer that hit everybody else. There was no safety for the officers against the men. It's only that when they came out of the line, the officers were able to have an officer's mess and perhaps better conditions. But the men, again, when they came out, were better looked after too. They had good conditions. Now, I don't think there was any... I never met a soldier with, a chip on his shoulder and an objection to his officers. Just the opposite. I seemed to be leaving good friends wherever I went. And I think that is so, if you're understanding. But probably your point is made there, and that is that they all knew that you'd been through the ranks. They all knew, therefore, that you knew what you were talking about when you talked about their troubles. No, I don't think there was any ill feeling there. Mind you, they might have had good and bad ones. I know I had one officer who was a very scared man and finally taken away to hospital, and that was that. And he wasn't happy with his men either, but then that was an exceptional occasion, you see, with the wrong man chosen for a commission.
Were you aware that you stood a much greater risk in going to France as an officer than being in the ranks?
Well, I should never think of any greater risk. The only time of greater risk, if any, would be when going into battle, which is not the same thing as months and months in the frontline trench. Everybody's in the same position. The officers had a dugout they used to go into, but it wasn't any more protected. It was just a little more comfortable. I mean, a shell would blow to pieces if it landed on it, and that was that. But the troops didn't have dugouts, I must admit, in the main. Of course, the Germans had amazingly deep dugouts. They were very good at that kind of thing, because we got dragged so many prisoners out of them in due course, but that comes later on.
Yes.
On the question of officers and other ranks out in Gallipoli, we found that being sent out there in light drill uniforms, we were a target for anybody to find, certainly no disguise. But the first thing we did, we found that our officers were being shot off too quickly as against the men. The first thing we did, everybody dropped all badges of rank. Stripes were taken off your arms and so on. And with the indelible pencil on your shoulder, you had a sergeant's stripes in indelible, and an officer's diamonds for their badges, and that was all that was allowed out there. Nobody wore a badge of rank. That could be seen from anywhere other than a few feet away.
Did that happen at all in France? You know, did you ever strip yourself of badges of rank, or take off your putties or anything?
No, I think the main point about it was that the officers in the main used to go up into the line with the men's uniform. I mean, we fought in there. The only difference was we did have the pips on the shoulders, you see, and that would be difficult to see except from a distance.
You mentioned earlier that you weren't too happy about going into the East Sussex.
The East Surrey, sorry. From the West Surrey to the East Surrey.
East Surrey, was it? Yes.
Well, that was only because there's a rivalry between the two regiments. Whenever we had a football match, it finished up with a fight. In the days of the camps, in the same way, it was always one against the other. So it amused me, having told them what good people the Queens were, to go along now, have to tell the recruits what a jolly fine lot the other ones were. I think I had the history of the East Surreys in due course and could use that as well.
How did you settle into the East Surreys?
Well, as soon as our commissions came out, we were quite soon after posted to France. And we had that terrible time at the Bull Ring at Boulogne on the way through, where officers and men were hardened and given extremely difficult times. We hated it there, everybody hated it there, and we were only too glad to get started up the line to get away from it. It was notoriously horrible, but it was a deliberate effort to make life harder out there to show them what they were in for.
Well, what sort of things did they do?
Bayonet practice, marching, drilling, physical training, all these things under a group of extremely unpopular and difficult men chosen, I think, for the job. In fact, to make it almost desirable to go back to the line rather than to be left down there. That was the worst side of it. I wasn't there for long, but everybody knew about this terrible Bull Ring and the way you were treated. It was part of the policy.
But what do you think of that yourself? Was it sensible?
I can't see any great advantage from it. On the other hand, of course, it gave them a taste, those who were going for the first time up to reinforcing the line, it gave them a taste of what the future will be from the point of view of discomfort, hardship and misery, all of which you might say would be more attuned to the front line. But, you know, we lived a life there that worked all right. Even we laugh occasionally. Speaking now of the 5th Battalion of the East Surreys, they were a fine band of Cockneys from Bermondsey. The mayor of Bermondsey had recruited this battalion, and if I remember rightly, they also sometimes wore a badge of the Bermondsey Town Council. They were notorious for the fact that they were very fierce in trench raids, and whenever they went over, they took a painted board with a red hand and a dagger in it. And they called themselves the Black Hand Gang. When life was difficult in the trenches, and every time you went past certain spots, snipers were firing madly at you and it was getting dangerous and so on, life was quite hard. But when there was a sudden change and there was a quietness about, and then you'd see a big notice board going up, Black Hand, don't shoot, we're Saxons. And there would be a quiet period in the line in which there was a very limited amount of firing. And as long as the Saxons were in front of us, we had a very quiet period. And
it would seem they had quite a reputation then.
They had a reputation. The Germans knew when they saw this board being left behind after they'd had a trench fight or something like that. Quite frankly, only once did the colonel send for me and send me out with a group to try to get a prisoner. And then, quite frankly, I wandered about no man's land in the night and darkness with my half a dozen men, plus my old batman who insisted upon coming with me whatever happened, and we didn't meet any other Germans. We stood rigid whenever a flare went up, because once you stood steady you couldn't be seen, but once you moved in the light they would fire. And quite frankly, I have nothing to report of having succeeded in doing anything brilliant. I merely brought my men back again.
What were your moves?
Well, then we were sent, group of officers actually sent up to the lines, and at that end we were then met our battalion for the first time, and we were then in due course taken up to the trenches and joined in the normal life of battalion at work, if you like. Some trips up to the line were unhappy, dangerous, number of casualties. Other trips were more peaceful. My bosom friend Lionel, he and I had joined together as privates. We were lance corporals, corporals and sergeants together. We both went to the Litchfield officers training, and he came out high as well. I've forgotten exactly where. And so we were together in France still, and that friendship went right the way through until that point. His father knew my father before the war. In fact, there was a friendly contact there.
What was his name, his second name?
His name was Lionel Russell. And I said, if I ever marry, my son will be Lionel. And my son, now in Australia, is Lionel, from that very reason.
I imagine this period, you know, of going in and out of the line, this would have been during a period of relative stalemate, would it?
Yes. We had the usual problems. The first thing, of course, is once you were up in the line in France, was the fact that you had a lot of uncomfortable things happening. For one thing, the officer in charge of the trench mortars would come along and say, I think I'll come along this evening. And we'd all say, can't you go down a little bit further? Don't come here. But they do. They come exactly where they said they would. And then at dusk, they would set up this wretched trench mortar and would fire about 20 rounds, pack up and dash off like anything to get back home, you see. In the meantime, we then had a day of shell fire at intervals to teach us to not do that again. So in other words, it was tit for tat, which was never very popular with us. They decided to have, before the battle of Messines, decided to have a really big gun practice, if you like, onto the Germans. And they said, we will evacuate our front line, but we will put a platoon down in the mouth of one of the entrances to the mines that they were digging, the deep mine depths they were digging. And this officer and 10 men should be there in case the Germans should come over. And so the officer chosen was my good friend Lionel. And so all day while we were back, away from the lines further back, we could hear this terrific pounding going on, saying, wonder how poor old Lionel and his men are getting on. Well, the end of this firing was over. The Germans had retaliated and recovered, and we were ordered back into the trenches, which by now were being pretty well battered about, so we got a bit of work to do to put them right. But I got along to this mouth of the where we knew the people were rescuing, and out of that came Lionel, blue in the face, and each man in the same way. Apparently, each time they looked out at all, the German shells had stirred up the blue mud that was coming up from the digging of these holes. And this mud had flung all over them, and they were all covered with blue mud, most of extraordinary appearance. It looked at first as if they were seriously damaged, but there was nothing wrong with them. And they'd all recovered quite safely, and then we patched our line up, went back to normal again.
So what area would this have been? How would you have identified that spot?
It was about round by St. Elwar. And in fact, that was our line of trenches most of the time, from round about St. Elwar.
It's interesting you talking about the mines. You know, were you fully aware that there were these big
mines? Oh, yes.
Mines.
Not only were we aware, because at night, you see, we'd see the Canadians come up, because nearly all Canadians doing it. The Canadian Tunnelling Company, they'd come up and we'd welcome them and say how do you do. And I went down once, it scared me to do so almost. We went down below such a depth, I could hardly believe it, down and down and down. And when we got down below there, they showed me quite a pleasant little mess room. And they were able to live quite comfortably there, 20, 30 feet below ground. But their great anxiety as they went digging on was hearing the other side doing the same. And they did sometimes have a blowout between one and the other, you see, and those who were doing the tunnelling of thereby had casualties. But they were marvellous holes. They were was cleverly dug. And the biggest one of all was one particular one in St. Elwar. But I'll come to that later in the battle. But actually, there was an interest to go down below, and I was quite scared down there, far more so than up in the trenches, the thought of finding yourself buried there forever.
I suppose one tried to keep these secret from the Germans. Would that have been rather difficult, you know, to have kept the activity?
Well,
I was wondering about this blue clay and that being thrown out.
Well, what they did, they took this clay much further afield. They took it round the back and all kind of the trenches and so on. At night time, they put it all over the place, so I think they hid it. But there are a lot of other interesting features there, too. For one thing, along our trench, at one point, behind the trench, was a very big old tree in which the branches had all been blown off by continuous shell fire. But the main tree, perhaps 4 feet through, still stood. And the clever Royal Engineers came along one night, and with a lot of digging and struggle, they managed to get it down. And the next morning, there it was again, apparently. But actually, it was made of sheet steel. And they had so camouflaged it that it was the tree just once again. And from underneath, the gunnery observation officer came through, climbed up in there, and all the day there with his field glasses was keeping an eye on many of the German trench movements and so on. And this lasted for nearly a week. Well, unfortunately, this was nearing winter time. We had a hoar frost one morning, and our tree stood up like a sore thumb. It could be seen from anywhere, and the Germans spotted what had happened, and they opened fire until they blew it down and got it out of the way. But we were very entertained by our famous tree and how long it lasted.
Yes, I suppose the frost wouldn't have clung to it, would it?
Because no, it just showed up white, you see, when everything else was dark around it.
Yes.
Another feature of our trench, which was very uncomfortable, that is, a stream must have run across it. But anyway, at all times, there was a portion of about 20 feet, which was definitely about 18 inches of water. And we nearly all wore gumboots, long gumboots, and we used to splash through it. But the trench level was fairly high, but if a soldier or anybody, officer or not soldier, trod into this pool on his way by and lifted his head up, he could be seen by the sniper, who could hear the water splashing and would promptly get him. And again, every now and then we'd find a soldier killed at that one point. So we had to put a notice on both sides and say, keep duck down through the water. For some time, conditions were fairly normal in the front line trenches, and we were told, however, that we were preparing for a big battle. And the first thing was the arrival, particularly by night, of many, many loads of shells, which were being stacked and hidden under branches and suitable hiding places. We ourselves were told all about it, and we marched to the open country near Saint-Omer, and I went to a little French farm where they were good enough to billet me for two or three nights in a very comfortable bed. By day, we came out and we found that on the hillside they had cut enough to show dummy trenches of the complete layout of the whole of the Messines trench area, the German side. And each day we made our attack up to these dummy trenches. But on the fourth day, we were rather staggered because they had organized for another unit from ours to act as enemy. And they appeared over the hilltop and through the trenches, and we in turn were supposed to be fighting them. It gave us a very realistic idea of what we might expect to meet in the battle. Back at Renninghalst, there was a very well-made model, a big thing, 10 or 15 feet square perhaps, in white plaster, in which every single object was repeated. Lines of trenches, position of everything. Because in front of us actually was the chateau, and we call it the White Chateau. That had been completely destroyed by bombing, but they had a complete German headquarters underneath it, and the Damstrasse, which was our first main objective, was a raised road that ran into the White Chateau. And under that is also honeycombed with many German dugouts. So by the time we had been sent to study the plan at Renninghalst and all the other items we had been trained in, came the period of the last night before the battle. And we were ordered to make our way to our front line trenches, but not to enter any trench, but to go above ground, which we did. And the Germans were fairly peaceful that night. They were not aware that it was going to be such a night of importance. And we got there fairly securely, but shells fell in to one of our adjacent companies, and there were a number of casualties. Not that we were particularly aware of this, but it did make a gap unknown to us. The time for 0 hour was 3:10 in the morning, and about 2 minutes before the 10 minutes, a burst of golden rockets went up in front of us, made a fine display, and was just too late. By the time the rockets were falling from the air, the time had come 3:10, and every gun along the whole of the front opened fire, and every machine gun opened with a curtain of fire right back to the back lines of the Germans. But most of all, at this critical moment, was a fearsome explosion, and the ground was rocking to such a degree that one more or less spread-eagled on the ground rather than falling down. And when the ground had completed movement, we then began to dash forward. We reached the lip of this enormous crater, and lying around were many German bodies. Later we met or found the sergeant major, and German sergeant, Feldwarfel, I think he was called. Anyway, we met his sergeant major, and he told us that he had a company of 200 men in that area, and not one of them had survived this enormous explosion. And those that were not actually near to it still had been blown down and in some cases killed by the force of the explosion. Of course, other mines were going up further along the line, but that was beyond our particular concern. We went around this great crater and then up to the pathway through to the White Chateau.
Did you come up against any resistance at all?
At that stage, no. But as we went a bit further along, they began to enter from deep dugouts, began to come out from deep dugouts, and began to throw their stick bombs. Ours were returned, but just when things were getting rather difficult, I was calling out to them, "Kommen Sie schneller raus," you know, and "Jetzt sind nur Kriegsgefangene," your prisoners. And they came up, hands up like that, quite calmly, because my little corporal was standing there, ushering them out and helping himself to their odd watches and other equipment, on the basis that somebody might get it and it might as well be him. He was a real Burmese boy.
Had you achieved your objective at this stage?
No, we were only halfway. We were still moving on. Now we've got a long way to go now, but we've now reached the trench area in which the Germans had retreated, and we had a comparatively smooth journey.